Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, we'll be talking with permaculturist Matthew Trum about some ways in which he's helping to restore property after the Bear Fire.
Pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm Stephen Schutte. Susan Schutte is with me tonight. We have a pre-recorded interview for you with Matthew Trum, who's been working on restoring properties following the Bear Fire, as he did 2 years ago following the Camp Fire. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We also want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Matt Trum.
Show me. Hey world, what just to go out for another day or two. Don't give up on me, I won't give up on you. Just believe in me like I believe in you. Tell me why on the corner all the kids used to come to run here. Load their guns here. And tell me why it's okay to kill in the name of the gods we pray. Tell me who said it's okay to die in the name of the lies we say. Tell me why there's child soldiers. Tell me why they close the borders. Tell me how to fight disease. And tell me now, won't you please? The only thing I want to do is to be in the arms of someone who believes in me like I believe in you. And I say, hey, oh world, what you say? Should I stick around for another day? Hey, oh world, what you say? Should I stick around?
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. And tonight we're going to play an interview that we recorded late last week with Matt Trum, who's the owner of Treetop Permaculture in Oroville and has done invaluable work restoring land after the campfire, and he's currently working with the community up in Berry Creek to restore the land there. We had all kinds of technical problems with this interview. We did it at home. We were under generator power at the moment. There are some glitches in here, and we may even have lost the second half of the interview. I'll play the first 27 minutes for you. I'll scramble around here in the studio, see if I can get the rest of it for you. Even with our technical interview problems, this is a great interview. Matt has so much to say. He's an incredibly intelligent, well-informed permaculturist, knows a lot about how to take care of the land.
Matthew Trum is the founder of Treetop Permaculture in Oroville, California, and the founder of the Campfire Restoration Project. We're going to spend a little bit of time talking about our recent fires, the Bear Fire and the North Complex West Fire, that are responsible for more loss of life and property here in the North State. But let's start by talking about how you got into the business of fire restoration work. So, Matt, please take us back to November 8th, 2018. How did you learn about the campfire, and what were your first reactions, and, what was going on that day for you?
Yeah, hi, and thank you guys for having me on once again. It's always nice to
good
come
to
on
see
Ecotopia.
You.
Yeah, and get the word out, and all the great things you guys are doing. So November 8th, it seems like it's been such a wild ride. that day, like many people, you know, we saw smoke, but during the late summer time, it's not really a huge red alert for you because we see smoke all the time. And I was driving my daughter up to Paradise, dropping her off at school. And she went to the Ponderosa Elementary School on the Pence Road up there. Mm-hmm. And so, we saw the smoke and it seemed like it was off in the distance. And we heard about a fire potentially over by Holga in that area, but, you know, didn't really raise too many red flags for us right away. I dropped her off at school and thought it was going to be another normal day in sunny, beautiful California, right, with all the fires that we have. And pretty quickly we learned. So that was about, 7:40 in the morning. And, you know, in that little stretch that I go up to through Pence Road and come back, you lose service. And when I got back down the hill in Oroville, my phone was just blowing up, you know, and you know, Facebook Messenger was blowing up and all these things. And I started to get on, you know, I started hearing all this stuff about Concow, and then, you know, it was, they were learning really fast, that it was becoming a much bigger situation than we thought. So I actually got all the way back to Oroville, and, you know, it was kind of like, well, do I turn around? And I'm trying to get a hold of her mom, because I had to go to work. I was trying to get a hold of my daughter's mom and didn't get a hold of her. And anyways, then a series of events happened. They had to rush her out, evacuate. Luckily, she had a friend, a parent who grabbed her, and they still ended up having to navigate flames and, you know, get their way out of paradise, evacuating out. So, you know, so immediately it was a personal thing, you know, for me, because of my daughter. But like in permaculture, we're always thinking about these things like water falling down landscape and slope. And it was really quick for me to start to realize, you know, after I realized the gravity of the event, like later that day, the next day, that this was going to turn into a major ecological situation. And we had rain in the forecast, I think already during the fire. So I knew, like, immediately I'm thinking water, erosion, oh my God, you know, there's going to be all these toxic materials that are going to get into the water system. You know, my mind was just going there thinking, who's out there going to be doing this work? Is anybody going to address this? And, you know, I know sort of the local landscape and the way that sort of government agencies work, and it was already becoming sort of an alarm for me. And that's how it all started. Yeah.
So did that concept of the campfire restoration project come to you within hours, within days? You know, when did you know that you were going to be doing this?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It was sort of a blur, you know, but the first couple of days, yeah, for sure. I knew immediately there was going to be restoration work that needed to get done, but I didn't think that I was going to have to get so active in the first part of it, as far as the runoff and the erosion, because I figured, you know, there's a government agency is going to do this, right? There's already a group out there that's going to do that. And, you know, I'm calling around, I'm asking questions, I'm talking to people I know who are part of that. I'm talking to Bill Connolly, I'm talking to a couple of people I have phone numbers with. And I realized really quickly that it wasn't moving fast enough to deal with any of that before the rains. And even after the rains, it wasn't significant. And nobody was really focused on it. So I realized actually after, it was about a week, I want to say later. And this was after one of my best friends also was up in Paradise, lost his house. And he had moved. I let him stay up in Berry Creek at our property temporarily. And then the fire had shifted, went across the hill. Berry Creek got evacuated, came down to Oroville. Oroville got evacuated. And when I was leaving Oroville, that's when I realized, I was like, wow, this is going to be a major thing. And we were just in this state of shock, you know, sort of saying, wow, if we don't do something about this, nobody's going to do something. And there's no way of getting away from it. So anyways, yeah. That was the beginning of it. And I put out a video and a call of response right afterwards.
So there were multiple phases to the project. Could you review those for us, please?
Yeah, so I really quickly kind of wrote up a rough draft, because I said, I'm going to need to go fund me to get started. I'm going to need to do these things. So I had to write up a pretty rough sketch. And it was phase one was to get staging sites for restoration materials and to have places where we could train people how to use them. And then to go out and actually do that training, do the education. And so I called up different people. I had started making connections with Callie Jane from the Fire Safe Council. It was one of my big connections. And actually that was unique because her parents were one of the first people that were certified in permaculture design back in the 80s. And she's the head of the Fire Safe Council. So she got me on a summit, the Fire Summit. I don't know if you guys remember that. There was the Wildfire Summit that was going to happen anyways in the first week of December, I want to say. And she got me up on the stage with one of seven different people. It was the mayor of Paradise, it was Cal Fire, forestry, you know, all the heavy hitters, like Resource Conservation District, Fire Safe Council, and permaculture guy, Matthew Trum. <You know? laughs> So it was sort of, it was a really unique opportunity, but because Callie Jane had been following me and she also knew how important this perspective and everything was, she got me on there and I started that conversation and started to make those connections with the big agencies. And I've been on a joint task force with these different groups ever since. So.
And that was phase one. Phase one was pulling the people together, staging your resources, which you needed a lot of. Mm-hmm. And then what did you do?
Well, and then going to forums like that and teaching, you know, essentially community alternatives. And we basically started to have meetings. That was the first thing we did. We were having community meetings. Seeing what the needs were, collecting data. That's what we're doing right now in this fire. Mm-hmm. We're collecting data and getting contact information. And we had to get permissions as well from community private property owners to go onto their properties. Mm-hmm. A lot happened. I mean, we had to, so I'm calling around trying to get into the burn scar before the evacuation orders were lifted, actually, before people could go back. And that wasn't happening in most places, right. But we did find out that there was a group in the Butte Creek Canyon that was starting that work. The Friends of Butte Creek, who were teamed up with Alan. Yes, exactly. Hawthorne and he was teamed up with the Fish and Wildlife and RCD. And they were able, because of the unique salmon habitat, to go in there. So we said, okay, we're going to support these guys. So I called volunteers to come out. We organized some action days together, brought out a bunch of materials to support them, and then went around Butte Creek and did that. And we were also able to then sort of forge that relationship with the Resource Conservation District to get wattles and things that were left over from those projects up to Concow and Paradise. And we were basically helping man the giveaway areas to, you know, to teach people how to use them, and also sending people out to their properties to help put the materials on site and sort of show them how to use it and everything.
And so what does it mean to restore the land? What does it mean to... what are the biggest concerns that the fire creates, and how was the land affected? I mean, we've seen it, but can you describe what that was and what it meant you had to do? You put the wattles out, that protected the water and kept the runoff from going into the creeks, and to keep toxins out of the water. Can you talk about other parts of restoring the land?
Yeah, so we often balance, you know, in these kind of fields between conservation and restoration. So conservation is like trying to restore what little that you have left, right? The little pockets of life that you have left. And then restoration is actually helping to bring forward life, bring in life into situations and nurse life back up. And so that's sort of what the immediate needs were there on the fire and any fire is, okay, let's make sure that more of the soil, the only soil that's left, doesn't run off. Let's make sure that the little bit of habitat that is remaining doesn't get polluted by these toxic chemicals and other heavy metals and things coming from these homes. And just doing anything like that in the immediate stages. And then long term, you know, which kind of goes back to like stage three and four for the project, which is more of focused on getting a restoration camp going. So we've founded the first ecosystem restoration camp in the U.S. and the first mobile type, you know, disaster response camp of its kind in the world. And that was, and, you know, that was doing a lot of different things. We had to look at the situation very differently. We focused on demonstration sites where we could really kind of hit them hard in these action days and, you know, bring in, you know, things like just materials to cover the ground, wood chips, straw, cover crop seeds, bringing in plants, native plants, planting trees, native trees. And in some situations, because we were working in semi urban spaces, like in Paradise at the schools and stuff, we were also bringing in fruit trees and other support species trees that are not necessarily native, but help bring back, you know, the health into that system. So those are the sorts of things, but it's soil building, right? Like, is the big one. Right. It's slowing, spreading and sinking water, right? So that's part of that. And doing little earthworks and things to help keep the water in place. Because our goal is to restore the hydrological cycles in these areas and also bring up the habitat. And the base level of all life is the soil biology. Mm-hmm. And we have plenty of sun, you know, right? It's like water, water and sun, right? Are the two big ones for life. And we have plenty of sun, but the water is the big one. And yeah. And then soil life to start the system back up again.
Could you jump back a little bit and tell us more about the structure of the camps? I'm having an image here of campers coming in. Okay, sorry, phone call there. How long did the camps last, and how many participants did you have?
Well, this is what's exciting about this, right, is this whole ecosystem restoration camp model is still really new. So the things that we came up with during Paradise Camp, during the campfire, you know, aftermath was all one of a kind. You know, it was all, we were cutting edge, coming up with new ideas. I literally was on the very first council for the ecosystem restoration camps. We met out in Los Altos and we came up with a plan for infrastructure, you know, literally right there. Me and John Liu, we actually were the ones who headed up the committee that day on infrastructure. And we literally came up with a whole bunch of the world's leading, you know, California's leading ecologists, permaculturists, you know, all these amazing folks. We sat down and said, okay, what do we need? You know, we need a kitchen. We need toilets. Well, we're going to do composting toilets, you know, so, and let's make everything mobile, right? So, because we're going to need to go to multiple places. So we're coming up with, you know, designs and everything for mobile composting toilets, mobile kitchen, you know, all the other little aspects, tools, you know, we're going to have a tool truck. We're going to have, and so we did that. And, you know, when I went down there for the first thing, which was on March 22nd, the following year, I knew that there wasn't really going to be a call to action. So I came with that call of action and we had just come up with a date, you know, for the first camp, April 25th. At that point, we still didn't have a ton of funding, but I just sort of stuck the flag in the ground and everybody helped out. We have about 100 people at the council meeting and everybody wanted to join. And we came up with that plan and we raised $20,000 in a month. And we put on the very first ecosystem restoration camp in the U.S. And it was pretty awesome. I mean, we spent a weekend. It was, started on Thursday through Sunday. And we went to a school up in Magalia that everything around it burned. And we worked on this school. We put about $10,000 into this school we built a garden. We helped remove a bunch of toxic materials out of the area. We built a food forest, demonstration site and build some swales to hold water and do water catchment, and planted, you know, trees. And anyways, it was amazing. And we also did a bunch of stuff on the campsite, which was at a farm that was sort of in between Oroville and Chico. The reason being that, you know, we needed somewhere that was far enough away from these areas that was safe, you know, to be at, because there wasn't a lot of places in the burn scar that were safe to be at yet. So we had this great spot that we had an area for camping and a kitchen, and we had those composting toilets made, and they were used, and, you know, and we all gathered together and sang songs, and went and did some restoration work. So it was really like everything I imagined what it could have been. And it gave a lot of people hope. And we had so much, the day on Sunday when we all gathered after the big event in Magalia, there wasn't a dry eye. I mean, every single person was there. We had local people who had been through the fires that said this was the first, you know, glimpse of hope that they've had since the fires. And, you know, what I found that was remarkable about it more than anything was, you know, learning that how healing it is to work in healing the land, and you're also, it ends up healing yourself, you know, and so many of the people from these areas are like that, you know, they're sort of do-it-yourselfers, you know, very independent type folks, and it's hard for them to ask for help and things like by going and helping to restore the landscape. They had incredible amounts of healing take place too. So it was pretty amazing.
Can you talk a little bit more about the involvement of John Liu and how that that partnership came about?
Yeah, so it's a crazy story. So right before the campfire, actually about 2 weeks before the fire, I was on a Facebook group thing, and I saw John writing, you know, chatting on there. And, you know, he's somebody I always looked up to. I mean, I watched all of his documentaries, whether, you know, Lessons from the Lowest Plateau or Hope in a Changing Climate or Green Gold. Green Gold was one of my favorites because it had my teacher, Jeff Lawton, in it, and who is one of also my all-time favorites. And my good friend Zach, who I mentioned earlier, had lost his home in Paradise, has been a huge influence for me, brought me into this whole world, really. You know, he used to always joke, we call him the Indiana Jones of restoration, John Liu, you know. And and I had been doing a lot of work in permaculture here in Oroville and everything, and I sent him a sort of like a press pack bio kind of thing, you know, to his Facebook thing. I figured, you know, this guy's not going to get back, you know, probably get back to me. He's probably got people all over the world. And he calls me that night from China. And we ended up talking for like an hour and a half. He played guitar while he was talking to me and stuff. It was pretty cool. And he said, you're doing amazing work, and I'd like to invite you to the first council, to be part of the council that I'm creating in California, because I think California is going to lead in the ecosystem restoration camps movement in the world. And that was the first time I ever heard the term of ecosystem restoration camps. And he gave me a little brief idea of what it was. And then, I said, yes, of course, I'm down to help. I didn't even know what it was, but I was down to work with him. And so he had sent me some info, and I was researching it online. And I say this, and it's probably in a million interviews by now, but it still is always very powerful. When I was looking up what the ecosystem restoration camps were, I saw a video of him describing eco camps, and at the end of the video he says, let's gather around the campfire and restore paradise.
Nice.
And you know, that didn't mean anything 2 weeks before the campfire. but after I was evacuating Oroville, you know, those words just kind of rang out in my head. And that's when I didn't mention that earlier, but I called John while we were evacuating my house after, you know, three evacuations later. And he answered his phone by accident. Apparently he tells me later, but, I said, John, it's paradise. Paradise burned. I said, you know, we've got to create a restoration camp here, you know, campfire paradise. Like, we have to do this. This has got to mean something. Right. And he said, oh my God, I'll support you however I can. And, you know, and now we're really good friends. In fact, I was just talking to him earlier on the phone, and we're meeting in Santa Cruz next week. And we're going to be doing an action day in Santa Cruz to teach the people from that community some restoration work, post-fire restoration. I was asked to come down to do a consult for that community. And then he's coming out here to stay with me, up in Berry Creek, for as maybe even indefinitely, at my property with me. So he wants to help me create another restoration camp for the Bear Fire. And he's been incredibly helpful, getting resources and things, for up there.
So before we move on to talk about the Bear Fire in Berry Creek and the West Complex, the North Complex Fire West, just describe a little bit more about the work that you've done in Paradise. And I know that you've worked up there until the last few days. what are some of the highlights of that work, and how is Paradise faring now?
Yeah, so it's interesting how do you really quantify some of this stuff. We do have a list of our accomplishments for the fire here. I'm pulling up, but basically the main thing we did was education. We did a whole lot of that. We had education. We had two main major camps. So the first one I described, it was in the spring, and then we had a fall camp, which was actually 10 days long, where we also went to several locations, but we did the main one at the Paradise Community Guild, where we built, we restored their gardens, and we, spread cover crop seeds, and we built some water harvesting systems in there. And we also had Rising Appalachia come out, the band come out and play for everybody. And we had our friend Miguel Elliott with the mobile cob oven that he cooks pizza out of. And, you know, there was just like layers upon layers of demonstration of, our goal, or our kind of mission statement for the Campfire Restoration Project is to joyfully cultivate harmony with humanity through nature, and to demonstrate regenerative community and to inspire a new human story. That's our official vision and mission statement. Yeah. And so that's what we really sort of strive to do. And we also gave out a whole bunch of information to the community throughout that whole year. We connected people with, experts to do consultations on their land. I did a lot of consultations on people's land, myself. And, and then we were able to continue to build, a relationship with the ecosystem restoration camps and sort of really work on our structure as an organization too. Cause that we sort of went really, really fast in the beginning. And then we had to pause and say, okay, first of all, do we, I had to even ask the question, are we going to continue this? Right. I mean, does this want to go on? And it was a wholehearted yes, by our group. We formed a board. We created our mission and vision statement. We had a strategic planning session and did all that kind of stuff. The work that nobody really likes to talk a bunch about, with the organizations, but super important work. I found an incredible person to basically take over my position in the end. First, it was sort of taking on a lot of the administrative type of stuff. But, I was training her. Geneva Sorensen is her name, and she is one of the most incredible people I ever met. And she's, you know, I knew at the moment I met her that she was going to be an amazing person to train. And she had a lot of these skills already, but it was really like I was holding a lot during that time. So being able to train, you know, the other people I were with, we got Stacy from Respectful Revolution.
Well, friends of Ecotopia, I'm sorry to report that that interview was cut off short. We had a bad week last week. Not as bad, I'm quick to point out, as people who've been involved in direct fire over the past few weeks. We recorded that interview with Matthew Trum on Zoom while running on generator power, and other problems intervened. But there are other resources that you can go to. I would strongly encourage you to go to campfirerestorationproject.com. There are a couple other interviews there with Matthew that you can get, including one with Stacy from Respectful Revolution. More information about the progress, the project, more information on how you can get involved and help out at this time. We'll take a little music break. Then I'm going to jump to the COP21 conference and talk a little bit about some of the issues that we're facing at the moment as we think about climate change, particularly in Africa.
Tell me which color is blue. Then stand in a line and shout, idiot, yours truly. Nothing compares to this feeling of flying. Gravity wants to join in for the ride. I don't know which one is true. The fool and the knave, they both have intuition, but foolproof plans which require 10 volumes to explain the subtleties just don't sound right. I will determine the last day on earth, and I will determine what Winston was saying, and I will make way for the peach and the pear and the plum. You will not fault what I've done. The concrete must yield to the steel, and some sun could reach me despite of the morning. Now patio living with no remote features could be a solution, but think of the mice. I will dig deeper than others have dared, and I will dig deeper regardless of warning, and I will make way for the peach and the pear and the plum. And you will not fault what I've done. No, 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 no.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. As I explained just a few minutes ago, we had some technical problems with a pre-record of our interview with Matthew Trum. Encourage you to go to his website, treetoppermaculture.org. You can also go to campfirerestoration.org to learn more about his work and to get involved. I'm going to turn now to some recent news from the UK Guardian, its environmental section, focusing particularly on issues in Africa. Sahel region, Sahel, S-A-H-E-L, region is a canary in the coal mine on climate, says a UN official. Africa's Sahel region is at the center of accelerating climate change and a canary in the coal mine of our warming planet, the United States United Nations top humanitarian official has said. I'll get this down in just a moment, folks. Mark Lowcock, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, said the Sahel was facing tragedy after an alarming deterioration in recent years that had led to tens of millions of people being displaced, rising extremist violence, massive violations of human rights, and growing political instability. Some of the record 13.4 million people who need humanitarian assistance across the border areas of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger have been forced to leave their homes by unprecedented flooding across West and Central Africa, underlining the threat that erratic weather caused by climate change poses to lives and livelihoods in the region. Though extreme weather exists elsewhere in the world, communities in the Sahel are much less resilient to changes resulting from climate change. Rapid population growth and traditional lifestyles reinforce the problem, Lowcock told The Guardian. Quote, it's very striking how bad the climate problem is, he said. There is totally inadequate level of international effort in helping these countries adapt to climate change. On some projections, the average daytime temperature in the area is expected to rise by 8 degrees by the end of the century. Traditional modes of agriculture are particularly vulnerable to shrinking resources such as grazing and trees, as well as water. On Tuesday, the UN, together with Denmark, Germany, and the EU, will host a ministerial conference on the humanitarian situation in the Central Sahel region. There is no disagreement on either side about the underlying problems, but there has not been adequate action taken. Whenever world leaders gather, the Sahel tends to be 8th, 9th, or 10th on the list of things to talk about, so it never gets the attention it deserves. Unless we change course and do more things and do them differently, the risks of a genuine global tragedy is going to mount. Problems brewing in the Sahel have contagion potential, and the risk to Europe are particularly transparent. On Friday, the EU's special envoy to the Sahel, Angelo Sanda Fernandez, described a perfect storm of crises in the region. Experts say these feed Islamist militancy. Extremist violence in the Sahel surged after a coalition of Islamists and local separatist tribesmen took control of much of the northern Mali in 2012. An 8-year campaign led by French troops, the deployment of hundreds of U.S. special forces, massive aid for local militaries, and the $1 billion-a-year U.N. peacekeeping operation have been unable to decisively weaken the multiple overlapping insurgencies in the region, and security has continued to deteriorate. Many of the bloodiest recent attacks have been attributed to an ISIS affiliate, the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, ISGS. Lowcock said groups were expanding their territory, but a future without Islamist militancy in the region was possible to imagine. This is a relatively new phenomenon, he said. The region has recently been rocked by renewed political upheaval, with the second coup in a decade unseating the elected government of Mali. Flagship environmental projects have failed to make significant impact. The Great Green Wall was conceived in 2007 by the African Union as a 4,350-mile cross-continental barrier stretching from Senegal to Djibouti that would hold back the deserts of the Sahara. Its supporters said it would improve livelihoods in one of the world's poorest regions. It would capture carbon dioxide, reduce conflict, terrorism, and migration. So far, only the project has covered 4% of its target area, according to a recent status report. In a report this year, the International Crisis Group said that if ongoing conflicts were attributed solely to climate change, there was a risk of underestimating the role of politics in the violence. This brings to mind a show that Susan and I will be doing next week. We'll be interviewing Alan Wiseman, who has written a couple of interesting books. We interviewed Alan about 4.5 years ago. His big issue in his new book at that point was global population and the risks that global population increases focus as we worry about climate change and other issues on the planet. Recently, he's received a good deal of publicity through The New Yorker in an article called Alan Weisman's Thought Experiment May Be Coming True. He had written an earlier book that we'll be talking about next week. It's called The World Without Us, in which he imagines a post-extinction, post-human extinction world, talks about not only the decay that would take place, water in the subways of New York and San Francisco, buildings, poorly constructed buildings falling apart, the Statue of Liberty falling into the sea around close to New York City, and so on. But he's also done a good deal of research on past problems around the world and how they suggest what might happen in a world without us. He looks, for example, at elephant populations and predicts that, in fact, the elements might be coming back if the world were not present. But he also predicts other kinds of issues, such as animal populations under their population increase, going red in tooth and claw, and how that's affected as their prosperity increases as our extinction takes place. And we'll even ask him about that. How doomed are we to mass extinction of humankind? What, if anything, can we do to prevent it if we choose to? Here's another article from The Guardian on the elephant topic. Why are elephants dying? The race to solve the mystery of the mass die-offs. Hundreds of animals perished in Botswana, and new deaths are reported in Zimbabwe. Now scientists are trying to find the cause. Earlier this year, more than 350 elephants mysteriously died in the Okavango Delta in Botswana. Individuals of all ages and both sexes were affected, and many walking in circles before dying suddenly in what was described as a conservation disaster. 3 months later, most surviving elephants have fled. Last week, a plane flew over the Okavango Panhandle, an area in the north and the west of the delta where most of the deaths occurred. 8 elephants were spotted when normally you would have seen hundreds. Unfortunately, The Guardian will not let me read the rest of that article to you. So I'm going to play our theme song at this point and look for a little more music to entertain you as my day on Ecotopia heads south.
Weave, weave, weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain. Weave me the hope of a new tomorrow and fill my cup again. Sing it with me. Out of the falling, out of the falling, weave.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ginger, and you are listening to Radioactive. That last song was Come As You Are by Nirvana, of course. And you know, I got a wonderful show for you guys lined up, full of excitement, because my life is very, very exciting and interesting. Totally. I basically can be, my life can be compared to the life of, like, I don't know, Hillary Clinton. She has an interesting life, doesn't she? Anyways, follow along to hear all my crazy stories. This next song is All My Life by the Foo Fighters. Please enjoy. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. I'm Ginger Nichols, and you are listening to Radioactive. So stay tuned, and please enjoy.
Searching for something, something never comes, never leads to nothing, nothing satisfies, but I'm getting close, closer to the prize at the end of the rope. All night long, I dream of the day, when it comes around and it's taken away, leaves me with the feeling that I feel the most, feel it come to life when I see your ghost. To the prize at the end of the rope. All night long, I dream of the day when it comes around and it's taken away. Leaves me with the feeling that I feel the most. Feel it come to life when I see your ghost. Then I'm done.